Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
On Heritage Radio Network, I'm your host, Brianna Kurtz. Each week, this show features a U.S. or international location and uses food and drink as a gateway to explore and celebrate the cuisine and culture of a destination. This week, though, we aren't focusing so much on a place, but more on a movement, the world takeover by ramen, if you will. And to help me discuss ramen and all things ramen, I'm joined by Kenshiro Uki, Vice President of Operations for Sun Noodle, and George Cao, Sales Manager for North America, and proprietors of Ramen Lab as well. So welcome, guys. Thank you for joining me today at Heritage.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I want to start by asking a kind of a deceptively simple question. What is ramen? What constitutes ramen? George, you want to take that?
Sure. I usually start by, you know, saying ramen is probably the ultimate bistro dish. What I mean by that is, you know, you have starch, vegetable, protein, and soup all in one bowl, one vehicle. So as a chef, I think it's the ultimate expression of one's craft. And, you know, as a consumer, it's a hearty bowl for $15.
And Kenshiro, let me put this question to you. So how did you get involved in all this? How did this all come about?
Well, Sun Noodle is a family business. My father started in 1981 in Hawaii. So as a family business, my sister and I, my mom, we were always involved around the company. And so after graduating from college, I really wanted to get into the family business and see what I could do to help with kind of the goals of what my father set.
And 1981, so you've kind of, and your father especially, has seen this kind of arc happen where ramen has become like what it once was in 1981 versus what it is today. That must be a really interesting kind of path to have been on. Yes. How, in your personal opinion, why do you think ramen has become so captivating to mostly American audiences is what I'm thinking about?
Well, I think there's a many different aspects of why it's so popular nowadays. I think one is there's a lot more interest in Japanese food culture. And so one of them being ramen is very, very popular, something to consume. Also, a lot of chefs can be very creative on how they present their bowl of ramen. So yes, there are the philosophy of what it takes to make a ramen, but within that, you can be very, very creative on using local ingredients to express yourself.
And do you think that the U.S., like this is something that was going on in Japan, the U.S. is kind of just like catching up in a way, or is it something that we're actually leading the way?
Well, I feel like outside of Japan, the U.S. is very much leading the innovation on crafting different bowls of ramen.
And how do you feel about ramen as kind of like fashion and pop culture? Either one of you can take this. You know, there's this soft power element where it's in books, it's in movies, it's in magazines, it's in art, it's on television, it's everywhere.
Yes. For myself, growing up, ramen wasn't cool. You know, at school, we'd be known as the noodle family, but kind of seeing this trend where it's kind of cool, you know, fashionable, really a hip thing to be a part of. To me right now, it's a very exciting time.
And as, you know, being in the food industry, you know, food is fashion to me. You know, it's every era you seem to have, you know, certain dishes that really elevate and captivate the audience. And right now, ramen, I think the fact that, you know, on a vocabulary sense, you know, we all grew up on the word ramen, understanding that it's that shelf-stable college, you know, principal food, but we're very fortunate to be able to elevate it to where, you know, chefs can really craft a very well thought out bowl of ramen. And today we have this amazingly sophisticated bowl that really feeds the masses. Anyone from, you know, the average Joe to, you know, people who dine at, you know, 3-star Michelin restaurants, they can all share a bowl of ramen.
And that's something else I wanted to just bring up before we move on and talk a little bit more about how you guys are working with ramen. I was in D.C. recently visiting, and I wanted to stop by a couple of my old haunts. I used to live in the area, and I went to a bar that's known for beers. They have like 300 different beers. It's called Church Key, and they had ramen on the menu. And then I went to a really famous bookstore, because you have to stop by Kramer's Books when you're in D.C., and they had ramen on the menu, and it's just like a little coffee cafe bookstore. Is that a good thing for ramen, or is it a little bit dangerous to kind of have ramen everywhere and everyone just calling everything ramen that they're doing?
I think there's a... first of all, I think it's great. Mm-hmm. You know, for us, I think people in the noodle-making business or ramen, you know, business, it's just like talking about a sandwich. You know, I think it's susceptible to everyone. I think there's no right or wrong ramen recipe or dish. And it's just your interpretation of maybe your emotional, you know, or your inspirational aspects of that week, at that day, and you're able to put together the noodle and soup. I think for, you know, all intents and purposes, it's the marriage between a wonderful soup that a chef, you know, puts together and perhaps a ramen noodle that, you know, we are able to craft with the chef. And that marriage between those two, how the noodles pair with the soup, is the magic behind a wonderful bowl of ramen.
That's an interesting way to put it, comparing it to a sandwich. I like that. So let's talk about Ramen Lab. What was the genesis of Ramen Lab? Why did you want to start it? And where are we at today?
Well, you know, it goes back to your other question. It's ramen spreading. Is it a good thing? Yes, it's a very good thing. But it's also very important for us to make sure that as it grows, that there's a foundation to that. And so the one key thing that I saw lacking when I first joined the company was that before I did join the company, a lot of Japanese expats would come to America and make ramen. Nowadays, you see a lot more non-Japanese people opening ramen shops, but what they need is a foundation, a base of where they can learn more about the craft of ramen, the right you know, notes of what to make what makes a good bowl of ramen. And so Ramen Lab, kind of this idea 4 years ago, was just to take care of that need. Where can we get more information about ramen? Where can we learn more about ramen, how to make ramen? That's the very first kind of strategy that we set. And to this day, it's the same. We've been fortunate that in here in New Jersey, where we started, doing the ramen flights was very much accepted by a lot of people. And we were fortunate, again, enough to have the opportunity to open a spot in Nolita in New York City, where we can then showcase the craft of ramen to the public, but also take care of the customers that we deal with.
And the word lab, it has this connotation that there's a lot of experimentation going on. Yes. And it's definitely an educational and a very active place. So yes. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about that behind the scenes and what you guys are doing and then how you're bringing that to all of us, all of your eaters.
Yes. So right now we focus more on the lab aspect of developing products that we feel give the right tools for customers to use to open a ramen shop or to create a menu. The lab also plays a part where staying true, you know, George can play put more on this, but the five elements of what makes a great bowl of ramen, and using that five elements and kind of sourcing local ingredients, that's a lab for us. It's, can we find the right ingredients to stay true to the philosophy, but create a New York style bowl of ramen? So the one that we did 6 months ago was a New Jersey tomato ramen. And this was staying true to the philosophy, but using local ingredients, and we got very good feedback. So it's, again, kind of pushing ourselves to the limit and seeing what we can do to advance the growth of ramen, but within people's reach.
What's going to be the cycle for the menu? So you're going to, every 6 months it changes, every season?
Right now, every month.
Every month.
We're thinking of launching a new menu, depending on the season, what's available, what the chef feels like he can do for that period.
The menu will stay small, though.
Very small. Yes. Very small.
Mm-hmm. And the space itself is quite small.
Yes.
And I know you guys, you had the success with the ramen flights. Mm-hmm. You're packed at Ramen Lab, you know, lines out the door, people freezing for their bowl of ramen. So why didn't you guys go a little bit bigger in space? Did you like want to keep it small in that kind of like Tokyo style of this old school ramen house?
Yes. Well, I think many parts in Tokyo, if you go to Ramen Lab, our Ramen Lab, that's pretty big for a Tokyo-sized ramen mm-hmm. shop. And so we wanted to kind of mimic what you would experience in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. Very small, a two-man operation. You can see everything. And also that what we call tachigui is a standing. And so we want the person who comes to visit us to understand that ramen is something to be consumed very quickly. The chef prepares everything at the moment so that you can experience the great bowl of ramen, the temperature, the texture. And one way is eating it quickly as well. So,
and I'm assuming as you move forward with Ramen Lab and experiment with all these different types of ramen, you're using different types of noodle for yes. each soup. So I'm unclear about this. Is Sun Noodle making 6 or 7, George, maybe different types of noodles?
Well, at Sun Noodle, I believe we make over 150 different types of noodles.
Okay, because on the website, there's 6 different ones. And then I read last week that there were 7, and now there's 150. So
in
break
general,
it down for
right.
me.
So in general, we like to break down the regionality of ramen. And you may notice on our website, we may have one called Tokyo Wavy, mm-hmm. a southern style called Hakata Tonkotsu noodles, a Sapporo miso style noodle. And these are all different styles of noodles that you'd see if you were to geographically travel throughout Japan. And I think, you know, when you're able to, fortunate enough, you know, in New York City, we have 60 or, you know, even 70 different ramen shops that focus on their individual styles. And, you know, within, you know, the southern style, perhaps the noodles are more brittle, thin, white, and relatively long for the slurp. These are all, you know, somewhat reverse engineered so that you're able to enjoy, again, the marriage between soup and noodle. So just very quickly, how we generally try to pair a noodle is by the viscosity, the flavor, and also what temperature in which the chef feels is best to showcase the noodle. So for instance, Tokyo-style noodle or Tokyo-style ramen noodles generally shoyu flavored with chicken stock. The noodles should be around 22 to 24 on the gauge. And this is really a little nerdy, but we're trying to measure and find out the perfect ratio between surface area of noodles and how much you're picking up on each bite or each slurp, and if you're grabbing onto enough noodles or enough soup and vice versa.
I like the nerdy noodle talk. And when you say gauge, you're talking about the thickness of the noodle?
Yes. So in general, and this is a universal connotation, but when we say 24 on the noodle gauge, that simply means within a width of 30 millimeters, how many strands of noodles are you able to cut?
Okay. And you guys are making new noodles all the time?
Yes.
Working with chefs all over the country, I'm assuming?
Yes. Right now we're fortunate even for Europe for customers. Yes.
Wow. Growing fast, I'm assuming. So, all right. Well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking more about Sun Noodle and Ramen Lab with Kenshiro Uki and George Cao.
Listening to Crying Blues by the California Honey Drops.
International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
right, we are back. I'm Brianna Kurtz, and you're listening to Native on Heritage Radio. And today I'm talking to Kenshiro Uki and George Cao of Sun Noodle and Ramen Lab. So guys, we were talking about in the first half of the show how ramen's really growing. And I wanted to kind of ask about how ramen's growing outside of cities, moving kind of more into, you know, less densely populated places with as... You know, we're very lucky in these, you know, L.A., New York, you know, these great gastronomic centers, but maybe just the average town and how ramen's spreading out there. George, do you want to take that?
Sure. Not so long ago, I believe we had a guest from Montclair, New Jersey come in and, you know, ramen shops popped up, you know, there. Rural areas in southern Jersey, D.C., Boston as well. So I do see that... It's gravitating towards the creative chef movement, and once you sit down and really think about just the five building blocks of what makes a great bowl of ramen, simply noodles, tare, which is the liquid seasoning, the stock, which gives you the viscosity, the density in the soup, the aromatic oils that when you slurp, it creates this very stereoscopic, you know, aromatic punch, and finally toppings. And as a chef, as a craftsman, if you're able to focus on those five key elements, more often than not, you have a tremendously balanced, harmonious, delicious bowl of ramen.
And you, during the break, we were talking about your recent trip to Europe and what you experienced there. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you're seeing the ramen trend in overseas.
Sure. I was, you know, very fortunate to be invited by our distributor in France to the Syrah International Food Show. This is held in Lyon every 2 years. This is also where they hold the Bocuse d'Or, a very prestigious culinary competition, kind of like the Food Olympics.
Yeah.
Right? And we had a tremendous showing. It was 4 days of you know, constantly making ramen, what our craft, and we're able to show, you know, not just, you know, a certain gauge thickness, but also the textures, and explain to people just the magic between or magic. What happens when we mix water, salt, kanshi, which is sodium, potassium, carbonate, and wheat flour together. Just these four basic ingredients we're able to manipulate into hundreds of different variations. And I think, you know, from a very culinary, sensitive culture, such as France or even, you know, in Spain, people really gravitate towards that nitty-gritty, those details. And nothing's better than when you cook, you know, something that you've made and you put a smile on someone's face. So that was very, very gratifying.
Are they putting their own kind of touch on it? I mean, like you say, ramen can be a template. It's a very creative space. Are you seeing like a French version of ramen? Are they using...
Absolutely. I think more so than anything, it all comes down to education and the way that we present what ramen is. I think if you can make similarities between people's culture and palate, such as, you know, in the world of ramen, we have what we call asarike and kotterike. Asarike is light, clear broth, and kotteri is very cloying, robust, more hearty. You know, the French have both. They have consommé, which is very nice and elegant, and they also have potage, right, which is very creamy and heavy. And when you make those similarities, I think it's instantaneous. You know, people really grab onto, you know, your spirit. And when you, you know, I can't help but smile when I talk about food. And when I do cook and feed people, it's really the best feeling. So I think, you know, through noodles, through cooking, through food, we're able to express not just, you know, business, but also culture and happiness.
And I want to kind of now, Kenshiro, I think I'll ask you this question, go the complete other direction. Do you think that there's a ramen bubble that might pop at some point?
And, you know, we always get this question. You know, they call it the ramen boom. And when is it going to end? Now, if we go by the amount of stores that are opening every month for ramen shops right now, perhaps at one point it'll slow down, but as a company that must lead and keep and sustain this industry, we do everything that we can to think about the next 5 years. What do people need for the next 5-10 years and keep this craft going? Because if we can share the knowledge of what a great bowl of craft ramen is, I feel like with the chefs that we have here in America and Europe, that they can take their creativity and, again, advance it, move it forward, and make ramen perhaps, you know, a comfort food for many Americans here. And that's something that we are responsible for.
And I want to talk about how you're moving not just into chefs, into restaurant kitchens, but also into home kitchens.
Yes.
I buy your noodles all the time at the store. I make ramen at home. I'm so happy I can buy your noodles more and more places. But maybe you can tell me a little bit more about how your initiatives in that regard of mm-hmm. to the home cook, yes. and also maybe your partnership that you have with Whole Foods.
Well, you know, one biggest challenge that we've always had is a home cook would imagine ramen as instant ramen, something that you can microwave or cook in 1 minute. But we also understand that we work with a lot of chefs, but the home cooks is also something that we wanted to target. Fresh ramen noodles with a ready-made soup base that you can make easy at home. And so our goal with this is that perhaps, you know, everyday household, if you wanted to make a bowl of ramen, perhaps you don't live in New York City or LA, but perhaps you live in right, you know, like Oklahoma City, where you don't have a ramen shop nearby, but you can have a great meal of ramen at home by using our products. For Whole Foods, we've been very, very fortunate that we are able to work with them. It was for us an opportunity to have in the hands of people who, you know, care about good products, to have fresh ramen noodles at home. And we've seen a very big impact by working with Whole Foods that the consumer understands the difference between fresh ramen noodles and instant ramen noodles. And so we've been very, very happy with what, you know, our partnership with Whole Foods.
Yeah, because I think the home cook, I mean, I think ramen can be a little intimidating, mm-hmm. but once you get work through that, you know, you can make a stock, you can make those kind of basic elements that George was talking about, but the noodles are the most intimidating part, yes. I think, for a home cook. I know getting that, it's just not the same, and mm-hmm. you guys are experts at it, so I like having your noodles at my disposal whenever I need them to make sure that my ramen's the best it can be, so... And I wanted to also ask you about the educational element. I see all the time on social media you guys are always working with children. So mm-hmm. maybe you can tell me about why that's so important to you and what you actually are doing with the kids.
I mean, we believe that, well, we've seen for myself, growing up, I only ate fresh ramen noodles. And so I didn't eat any instant ramen. So when I grow up, when I'm, you know, I'm 28 now, but looking back, eating that fresh miso ramen for me is very nostalgic. Right now for the kids, we really want to show them what fresh ramen is, so that when they grow up, let's say when they have kids, that they can make ramen for their kids, and so it kind of continues through the generations of you know, a great bowl of ramen.
And yeah, just to add a point, cooking with children, I think they're so innocent and open to new ideas that what better point in their life is it that we can introduce great ingredients as well? You know, it's not just the noodles or the soup, but, you know, it breaks my heart sometimes when I hear that inner city school kids have never seen an apple or you know, washed vegetables before, and all this processed food that we're kind of, you know, inundated with here in the States. It's kind of hard to battle against, you know, big corporate America sometimes. But when we're able to work with these great organizations and kind of mentor, you know, young kids to learn how to cook, it's just great that through the vehicle of ramen, where, you know, we have that starch and now the soup, but, you know, getting the right proteins, the vegetables and different seasonings, we're able to really create, you know, that foundation or the fundamentals of cooking and instill that upon, you know, young kids at an early age.
And I want to now move to a couple really selfish questions, like some things that I'm just wondering personally. So I love ramen, but I also love soba. And I was wondering if you had any personal opinions on why ramen has become kind of like the supreme noodle and soba's kind of been left behind. Because it definitely has the a very deep culinary tradition in mm-hmm. Japan as well.
From a manufacturing standpoint, mm-hmm. soba, I would say, is extremely, extremely hard to make. You know, the best soba houses in Japan pride themselves on using what they call towari, or 100% soba buckwheat. Mm-hmm. There's no gluten. You know, buckwheat is buckwheat, and it's very hard to buy. And so the great soba houses are able to create a fantastic noodle through extreme technique and small batch, small production. Unfortunately, you know, when we get into the commodity world of soba, sometimes, you know, in the worst case scenario, it's only 20% soba, all, you know, and a lot of cheaper commodity wheat flour. So the essence of soba is lost. And I think, you know, in terms of the voice of craft foods, it's hard to, you know, kind of stand behind that. You know, there's just so many variations. Whereas ramen noodles, I think, for one, it's not just the noodle itself. It's not carrying the weight of the dish. You also have, you know, the collaboration between the chef's soup, the broth, the tare, the toppings. And there's so many stories. There's so many elements that I think can captivate a customer. You eat with your eyes, then your nose, then finally your mouth, and then the texture, the temperature. There's so many things that, you know, play such a wonderful factor in giving you that harmony in a ramen dish. I think it's just perhaps easier to understand, you know, right out of the gate. But, you know, not to say, soba is extremely deep, and I have a tremendous respect for soba masters, and I truly enjoy soba as well, but it's hard to find really good soba. Mm-hmm.
I think that helps me get a little more clarity on why that might have been. And then I need your help also. So I was recently in Tokyo, and I just want to eat tsukumen all the time. Where can I find the best tsukumen in New York?
Ooh,
because it's not one of the most popular. I especially like the prawn or like the fish based ones. You have to help me feed my addiction.
So tsukumen, first of all, is noodles and soup now separated, right? And you'll notice that the tsukumen dipping soup or the sauce is extremely viscous, very rich. I think we should just take one step back and understand the evolution of how that came to be. Back in around 1910, the first credited ramen store in Tokyo, Raidaiken, started off with what they call torigara shoyu ramen, which is a lighter, more clear broth chicken soup seasoned with shoyu. And as the years progressed, every decade, every two decades, something new popped up. In 1937, the tonkotsu ramen came to be. In around 1955, the miso ramen, even a heartier dish, came to be. Until around 1960, that tsukumen started popping up, but it wasn't until the 90s where tsukumen really exploded. And today, tsukumen, probably the richest, heaviest dipping soup in ramen, exists. And I think what's really interesting about the dynamic of, you know, the tastiest tsukumen is the marriage between pork and then shellfish or seafood. You know, two animals that normally in nature would never meet, but you know, through the creativity of mankind, we're able to put that into a dish. And it's rich, it's sweet, it's, you know, savory, and the noodles always are very chewy, very you know, has a nice, you know, al dente-ness to it. And, you know, it's very fulfilling. I think in the next 2-3 years in New York City, tsukumen will take off tremendously well. And, you know, we're very looking forward to it, actually.
I hope so. I hope you're right. But in the meantime, I'll just have to keep looking and, I guess, be patient, unfortunately. Well, we're about out of time. So where can people find out more about you guys?
Right now, we're working on adding more content to our website, sunnoodle.com. Also, if you are able to, please visit our ramen lab in New York City. And we're also very much into social media, so Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Ken, Shiro, and George. That's all for Native this week. Next week, Savour Magazine will be back on the show talking about their new edition featuring Tasmania, which is sure to be an adventure and very interesting. Be sure to tune in live every week right here at Thursdays at 11 a.m.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.